Good morning, and thank you. I'd like to tell you about a project that the Oregon Immunization Program conducted with its local health department partners last fall. And this is the official title of the grant we submitted and received awarding for, but I'm going to call it the scanning grant from now on because it's shorter, and you'll see why in a minute. First, I'd like to acknowledge the individuals in yellow are my co-authors on this, the final grant report, but it took the effort of many people to pull this off, and I just want to thank them and give them acknowledgments. So I'm hoping to come out with some useful information from this presentation, so I just put in a few learning objectives. You know, I hope you understand what optical character recognition software does. Give two examples of countermeasures. A lot of this is terminology is preparedness lingo, and I'm never sure how much other immunization people understand that lingo. State two benefits of the technology we'll be talking about and two challenges in fielding it. So the purpose of the project was to see if scanning and optical character recognition technology was a viable option for collecting vaccine administration data during a pandemic influenza. And I'll talk about how OCR works in a little bit, but I wanted to first mention the factors that led us to put together this grant proposal. As Howard said, a couple years ago, the immunization program took on the responsibility for the Strategic National Stockpile Program for Oregon. And with that comes the responsibility for oversight for local mass dispensing activities and the city's readiness initiative program, which basically the CRI program is responsible for planning to respond to an anthrax attack or prophylaxing the entire population within 48 hours of the decision to do so. So you can see under those conditions and during an influenza pandemic that we may be talking about capturing data for thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of individuals, depending on when, say, during a pan flu, the vaccine is released and who the priority groups are. We're also, the immunization program also takes the lead, my colleague Maureen Cassidy, on countermeasure and response administration work. This is a picture of one of the clinics I'll talk about later for our fall project, where our CRI staff are receiving their flu vaccine at a drive-through pod. But as part of this program, part under the CRI responsibility, we also take the lead on doing the doses or the DAX exercises that Jeannie talked about. And we're starting to see how everything was kind of flowing together. Okay, we got to collect the data, and then we got to transmit it to the CDC. And we're figuring out how are we going to go about doing this, looking at this, collecting this large volume of data. And so naturally, we turned to our Alert IIS, our information system, and thought, well, maybe that might be the route to go, much to the chagrin of my managers. Sorry. And then surrounding all of this, we're trying to put all these puzzle pieces together, are requirements for FIN-MS. So basically secure messaging when you're transmitting this type of data. And so FIN impacts Alert IIS, which you know involves SNS, and then CRA. So a possible or potential solution presented itself in a master's thesis conducted by Wesley Atkins for the Oregon Health and Sciences University Department of Medical Informatics. And his thesis actually was looking at how they might use automated data capture for routine immunizations. Basically, you would use a scanner to take the form, the vaccine administration record, scan in the image, and then what the OCR software does is it pops up the image, and then you can make corrections to it. You can set parameters around characters. I like to think of them, given my statistical background, as confidence intervals. So if somebody writes a 7, but there's a little hook on it or something, the computer will ask you, do you want to accept this as a 7? Or if something looks like a B instead of an R, do you want to accept this as a B rather than an R? So, and then you just, once you make the correction, then you save the image and then you can upload it into your information system. And Atkins found that just with routine immunizations and what they do with their the paper VARs that they receive, you might see a return on investment on anywhere from 2 to 6 months, depending on the workload. So a return on the investment in terms of the money you put in to purchase the equipment. Now for this project, just wanted to briefly mention the concept of operations. We're thinking, so we're putting together then, collecting, we have these annual flu clinics, collecting the data for that, you know, pretending it's a pan flu, and then capturing it in our IS, and then using the DAX information, you know, transmitting it to the CDC. So the way we thought we might do this, one way we could do this at the local level, and this was basically a proof of concept project, it wasn't a heavy duty research project, but is we would take the equipment we purchased, collect the forms at the data collection station. My colleague Maureen and I attended 7 of the 8 clinics and manned the data collection stations, scan in the image, make the corrections there, and then you can transmit the information via the web or save it to a hard drive and carry it later to upload into our IIS. Or another way this might work is to have the local health department send in their forms to us. I forgot to mention that it was back in about 2005 that we started to see we might need to provide individual level data or collect individual level data for our IIS and then transmit aggregated data.
We understand.
To the CDC. But we were trying to figure out how to do that. So we did a needs assessment with our local, some state and federal partners on what this might look like. And our local health department partner said, yeah, we'd be glad to help you collect the data, but we won't have any time to do data entry. Probably like in many places, the staff wear many hats. And but they also said, but if we do give you the data, we'd like a report in about 48 hours, you know, back. Like, okay. So that was kind of the impetus of, okay, so how are we going to do this quickly and turn it around? So another idea we had was, well, if the local health departments are very busy and they're in a pan flu, they're going to be down maybe by 30% their staffing levels, they could send us the forms. And then we could use a production level scanner, which, you know, shoots in a lot of forms rapidly, and then do the same thing, correct the errors, and submit the data to the alert IIS. So the activities we did for the project, we piloted between August and February this past month, and we had 8 local health departments who participated in the scanning grant, or actually 7 participated in the scanning grant and 8 participated in the DAX exercise. It turned out that when we offered the, when we first mentioned, you know, I was jealous of Ellen, she got a lot of volunteers for her participation, but when we asked our counties, they're very lukewarm on doing the DAX exercise because they knew it involved data entry. But then when we got this grant award, we said, we'll do it for you, scanning, you know, we'll collect the data. The floodgates opened. They were very happy to help us out. So we, with the local health departments, and I think are going to have passed around, we developed single and multi-person vaccine administration records, scannable versions, English and Spanish. And on the front side is the public side that they were supposed to fill out, and the clinical side was on the back. And we worked on procuring the equipment, which turned out to be a big challenge for us. Our recommendation that came out of this is, if you're going to replicate this, allow 6 to 12 months to work with your procurement process, because it really held us back in many ways. And then we were implementing a project evaluation. How much time? Oh, okay. So basically, our evaluation consisted of looking at who's faster, man or machine, in terms of, you know, data entry. And we also looked at data quality, too. So this is these are the vaccine administration records from seven of our eight clinics. I think one of our technical staff had the remaining stack. So you can see, you know, it's a big chunk of information to be looking at. And the number of variables we were transmitting to the CDC for DAX are 10. Most of them demographic, but they had also included the pan-flu tier group assignment. And I wanted to mention something else, but I'm blanking on that right now. So, and these are the, pictures of the two of the scanners we bought. One on the left is a production level scanner, and then the other is a portable desktop scanner, and that would be the one we would take out into the field with us and hook up to a computer and do the work on. So what we ended up doing, because we had such difficulty with our procurement process, we weren't able for those clinics to take the scanners out into the field, but we were able to develop the forms, go man the data collection station, do quality checks on the forms, and then we came back to the office, and later by January we did have the equipment, so we were able to do some comparison of manual versus machine data entry. But for data quality, what we looked at were error rates, or in the literature they talk about OCR software looking at verification rates, so that's basically, you know, what is this, a 7 or a 1, that type of thing. But we also looked at other types of errors, overlooked fields, things that people skip, characters out of the box, you know, wrote their, you know, an S outside the box, multiple characters in one box, it's amazing how many people did that, unreadable characters, and boxes not checked. And the reason we did this, because we had been given a demonstration of this OCR software, and we knew kind of what it would be looking for in terms of asking us what our errors, so we did this manually on our own. And we also looked at errors around pan-flu, tier group assignment, and then the timing. So in the results for verification, we took, because this is, we're going to be completing phase two, we'll do more of the evaluation process. We just looked at a sample of 100 forms. And on average, there were very few errors. There was about 1 to 8 errors per form, depending on the type of error. With the Spanish language form, there were high counts for, they had the highest counts for overlooked fields, characters out of the box, and multiple characters placed in one box. For the single and multi-person form, both languages, everybody has bad handwriting, no matter what language you speak. So they were very similar accounts on that. And you'll be able to see, if you look at the multi-person form, the kind of complexity of it. It was a challenge. And the multi-person form was problematic for all. They had the highest counts, error rates across it. But the people really liked the multi-person form, though. The local health departments asked us for it in the beginning of the project so that when a mom or dad comes in with their 3 kids, they're not having to juggle 3 different forms while also taking care of the kids. And we got anecdotal feedback from parents, too, that they also appreciating had one form to fill out, although it was a little challenging. So for verification, clinicians seemed to have few problems on their side of the form, but I think that was because we made it easy on them and we pre-filled a lot of the information, you know, the lot number, the dose, the date, and that type of thing. And but they seem to be an independent bunch, and even though you give them a box to check, they would circle it. So, you know, so we need to figure out with our OCR software people if, can you pick up circles instead of check marks? And, so, and this is a picture from, we had one county who did our first drive-through. It was a large-scale drive-through pod, and they also had a walk-through pod for families, and people said they had a history of fainting after injections. So recommendations around verification, We hope to build familiarity with the forms. This was new to many people, but I think if we use it more routinely in our exercises, both the staff and perhaps the public will become familiar with it. And I think we need to emphasize the role of pod screeners. Those are the people who help people fill out the form, they check the form, and put the information on it. Maureen and I were often at large pods. As the data collection people, we were the last ones to see the form. We'd review it one last time, and even though that form might have gone three different staff hands, there was still a number of errors on it. And then we just have a very simple recommendation of emphasizing the instructions, print neatly in one letter or number in one box. So results for the tier group assignment, we looked at a sample of 100 single person forms. And the tier group assignment was misclassified in 24 out of 100 forms, which is pretty high, I think. And I believe that problem may be exacerbated if you have multiple tier groups eligible at one time for vaccination during an influenza pandemic, or if the tier group eligibility changes. Staff get used to looking for certain questions, and then it changes on them. Or the tier group assignment takes place in what's often a fast-paced, high-stress environment of the point of dispensing. And I don't know if I explained what that is. That point of dispensing is equivalent to a mass clinic. So our recommendation, if at all possible, we think the human element should be removed from the tier group assignment, using a computer algorithm or whatever. With the OCR software, you're collecting the data, inputting it into the IIS, and you can create an algorithm that then looks for the questions and plugs people into the right tier group assignment. Or another option is to develop online or e-training for your pod staff. So, and they can do that ahead of time so that they won't be so, it's hard to take in new information under high stress environment. So they could do it ahead of the pod in maybe 10 to 15 minutes. So findings around manual versus electronic data entry. Kind of the best estimate, we did manual entering under a variety of different situations. In the clinic or at the pod site and then back at the office. And our best estimate was that it took about 1.3 minutes to review the form, verify, the information on it, and then enter it. We entered it, like Ellen did, into our temporary module for our alert IIS. And if you extrapolate that to 100 forms, that's about 2.2 hours per form. And I want to say that it was, when we were in the pod, Maureen and I at the data collection table, the process fell apart very fast, data entry, with only two people, the throughput of more than 90 people per hour. You would have to have dedicated staff off in a separate room doing this type of work, because not only were we trying to do data entry, but people had a lot of questions for us, plus we were trying to fill in the blanks and correct the errors on the forms. So we took that finding from manual data entry and looked at it for a desktop scanner, compared to a desktop scanner. And it basically took 2.6 minutes to walk to the scanner and load the hopper, scan 20 forms, and answer the dialog box and save the images. And if you extrapolate that to 100 forms, it took about 13 minutes total time. But that excludes verification, where you're looking at and correcting the errors. When you look at the production level scanner, it took about 1 minute and 9 seconds to walk to the scanner and load the hopper, scan 100 forms, answer the dialog box, and save the images. And that also excludes verification as part of the process. So what we did until in phase two, we're going to do it where we include verification, with the software right there. But until that time, we added on 45 seconds per form for verification for scanning and for the desktop scanner and the production level scanner. And I think that's a pretty conservative estimate, given that there was only 1 to 8 errors per form And then we made the, now we can make a more complete comparison between manual data entry, desktop scanning, and production level scanners. So we see that desktop, or the manual took about 132 minutes, the desktop scanner took about 88 minutes, and the production level scanning took about 76 minutes for the whole process of scanning or entering and reviewing 100 forms. And if you look at it in terms of time savings, in comparison to manual data entry, that's a 33% time savings for desktop scanning and 42% time savings for production level scanner. And so our conclusions are scanning and OCR software technology is a very feasible time-saving solution to trying to capture vaccine administration data during a pandemic influenza. In phase two, what we're going to do is complete the training on the software, do our final configurations around the software and the equipment, and design workflows with our Alert IIS system. And then we're going to redo the evaluation, as I said, a rigorous comparison of the whole process from, reviewing the forms and then scanning and entering them. And we're also going to continue to field test our equipment. We were able, with the grant monies, to buy a portable ID scanner. It's a very cool instrument. You just slide in your driver's license, and it brings up an image of both sides, front and back. And so what we're thinking with this is maybe down the road we could tie, that would also improve our data quality because you have a nice typewritten version of a person's name. And if somehow we could capture, tie that information to our vaccine administration record and then save it, it would just improve the data quality a lot and maybe the speed with which we can do it. But we're going to try, we have a TDAP pod coming up in May at a county. We're going to field test this, and then also we're going to continue to use this next fall for our flu vaccination pods in the 2009 DAX. With the portable scanner, though, I must say the first step I'd like to see us take is in Oregon, people are very private, and I'm not sure that they want to hand over their driver's license and let the government scan in an image. So I think the first step at either this TDAP pod or one of the pods in the fall is to do a survey of people as they're coming through the pod and say, would you be willing to do this for us during an event? And that's it. And if you have... you want copies of our form or our final report or anything, feel free to give me a call or send me an email. Thank you.
Very nice presentation, Kathy. And as you can see, it's a very timely issue, too, as we approach this issue of how you do screening during surge and how do you handle volume. And I think maybe you should ask Ellen to ship some of her volunteers over to Oregon so that you could get this job done. Now I would open this up for questions and answers for a little while. So if you have a question, if you step to the microphone in the center, please identify yourself and to whom your question is directed.
Good morning, I'm Jim Bueller from Emory University in Atlanta. I have a question and a comment. First, my comment, I'm the project lead for an investigation that the Emergency Preparedness Office at CDC is funding. And as part of that, we're working with AIM and ERA and Dr. Hinman to study how immunization programs have responded to shortages, but also to study how immunization programs are working with emergency preparedness programs. And we look forward to reporting on that at the conference next year. My question for Ellen Gish is, you mentioned that you had a chance to apply your experience from the DAX to a flood situation where you were dispensing a tetanus vaccine. And I wonder if you could just expand a bit on that crossover benefit between the DAX experience and an actual more crisis-like situation, and perhaps how you may also see further crossover benefits, perhaps, say, in your city readiness initiative activities.
That's a great question. I'm glad you asked it. We, in the Emergency Operations Center, one of the things that we do is we have to be able to give rather real-time and quickly what's going on at the local level, because the governor wants to know. We also need to be in a position to administer vaccine, get vaccine rather quickly. And I was in the Emergency Preparedness Program prior to entering into the immunization program. So the past 3 years I have spent building a relationship with that program, building trust, and then also being able to translate that into best practices. And one of the things that we are trying to do is we got a grant to for more expedient methods to capture this information. I would like to do some, or explore some form of barcoding for inventory tracking. Our registry also tracks antivirals and medication dispensing. The registry that you shot that you saw showing the tetanus. But we, in 2007, we were also in a declared disaster, and we had to show FEMA the basically priority groups, whether a child in a shelter or an adult in a shelter of first responders. So we had to show that information, and so we've kind of translated that into a routine kind of relationship. We crosswalk, we do sit in separate buildings, but we have built a relationship.
Thank you.
I also have copies of the report that is updated into CDC if you're interested in viewing that also.
Laurel.
Laurel Wood from Alaska. A comment and a question both. The first thing is on the tier group algorithms, that was one of those things that sort of made my eyes cross last year, because you go, this is just too complicated. And I'm pretty sure it was California that came up with the same system that we ended up using, which you handed the patient the form and it was just to answer these really quick questions. There wasn't anything on there with arrows. There wasn't anything with big long words or anything like that. And I really think that that made a huge difference in our ability to quickly process that tier group stuff, because all the algorithms, it's more than I can take sometimes. And I'm wondering how many other people did that very simplified version that California, at least I'm pretty sure I'm attributing it to the right state, came up with these real simple check boxes. Yeah, it makes life so much easier, and if people aren't aware of that, then we ought to make sure that gets shared very widely, because the tier group thing was a problem.
Can I mention, make a comment on how we did in Oregon? We also, it was the client who checked off. We had different questions or data capture boxes that they would check off, and then it was the screener who determined, or the shooter who determined the tier group assignment. And even with that, we still had saw high error rates. So.
Laurel, thank you for saying that. California did produce a screening form. The example that I shared around was an example of how a health jurisdiction thought it would be simple to capture the priority groups. So, yes, California did a fabulous job and shared their information with us.
Thank you. And then the second thing I wanted to tell you was that we tried something really odd in December of this year that worked better than I had thought that it might. We had this wasn't related to DAX, we had a TDAP clinic in a community where we've had a large pertussis outbreak going on. And we decided to try something a little different, and we did indeed have paper. We discussed for a while not going completely paperless on this whole thing, and that made lots of people very nervous. And I don't know if anyone's ever really done a completely paperless project like this. But we ended up having a laptop computer at the table, at each administration table. As soon as the person walked up, they did indeed have a paper. We rapidly put their name in, saw if they were already in the system in some way, input the information. We had quite a few people that would have ended up getting a TDAP that didn't need one if it hadn't been for this system. So literally, by the time the person walked away from the table, the data was entered, it was done. And then we did have the paper as backup. It went so much faster. Our nurses were very, very hesitant that this could possibly work and wouldn't have completely held up the system. By the time we got to the end, every one of them said, this is the way we ought to do it every time. So it's just sort of a switch to think about having the computer at the table, and it worked well.
Thanks, Laura.
Hi, Kendall Patterson from Dover, Delaware. Just comments for Kathy, and I saw a question about the reporting. For the driver's license that you're looking to implement, a way to probably get around that would be to tell your citizens that we're the government. We already have your driver's license. So showing it to us doesn't really hurt anything. It's true.
That's a good point.
Also, for the when you were able to get the scanners to do the field reporting, were you able to pull any reports in real time so that way anyone in high could see some preliminary numbers of how many people were vaccinating, anything like that?
Sorry, there's an echo here. So are you asking about real-time numbers?
Yeah, somewhat real-time reporting.
Yeah, that's a great point, because at the data collection table, I didn't anticipate this, but the pod supervisor hourly would come up to us, and because we didn't have the scanners in that field at the time, so how many have we vaccinated? And if we could do that in the field right there with the computer, that would be easy to get. Otherwise, we're thumbing through very quickly.
Thank you.
Sure. Thank you. That's a great idea about the driver's license. I don't know if that telling Oregonians we're from the government, is going to help.
Hi, I'm Anna Dreyfus from Houston. And I want to thank you for your excellent presentations. I thought they were really great. We on the Gulf Coast are especially sensitive to the need for immunization information in public health disasters. And I was just curious if you could talk a little bit about using registries to store first responder data, because what we found was that because of some legislation in our last session, we are allowed to keep first responder data in our registry, which for most of you probably wouldn't be a big deal, but in Texas that was a major milestone. And, but what we found during Hurricane Ike was that many first responders were actually lining up with victims of Hurricane Ike to get their tetanus boosters so that they could go off and do their jobs, which really kind of shocked me. I don't know if I was naive, but it did shock me, because I would think that first responders would be the first to be prepared. And I was wondering if anybody could speak to the topic of preparing our first responders and using a registry to identify people who are not up to date with their vaccine.
Do you want to talk? Go ahead. Well, I think in Oregon we need to do more work with our first responders. You're right. They're, I think, a higher priority group for basically any kind of event. And fortunately, our alert immunization registry, we had legislation passed not long ago to make it a lifetime registry. But so it sounds like you're saying, how do we get them taken care of first? Yeah, I think there are other states who are a little farther ahead of us on that. But I think we would put the word out. We have a good system in place to put the word out that they can, stand up a pod at their own. We have counties who have worked with them, stand up a pod at their own fire stations or whatever. But we'd have to give them access to alert if we want them to input the data there. And I think it's going to take some more training around it, because I'm sure they're not familiar with the IIS systems. I'm not sure I'm answering your question, but do you have any?
In our registry, it's a great question. In our registry, we have a first responder tracking module that actually tracks additional information that's not captured in the normal IIS immunization system. And we are working with emergency preparedness to try to identify, because they also have a volunteer registry and credentialing system that does not track vaccinations. So we're trying to crosswalk how and what we would do in that situation. But our registry is also a lifetime registry, so if they've received a vaccination, most likely they're captured in our registry, just not as a first responder. So we're working on that issue.
One quick point I want to make is that our two states have a data sharing agreement between our IS systems, and I'm hoping that'll be helpful down the road sometime.
Okay, next question, please.
Hi, I'm Nicole Lambert from the Kansas Munition Registry. I just have actually two questions for Catherine. The first is, with those scanning forms, when you actually reintroduced them to the IIS, what was your matchup scope? Like, how many didn't match because spelling was wrong, first name didn't quite match, and then did you account for that into your actual time you spent versus automated versus the manual?
Yeah, no, I could only estimate it in this phase one because we got our equipment so late and we're still trying to get a training on our software. So that'll be part of our phase two report. So we're just not there yet. So that was the 45 seconds I tagged on as a kind of conservative estimate of how that would work.
But, and then also, does your CRA piece, does it decrement from inventory or is that just not even in there?
Yeah, no, what we're doing, IIS system is undergoing an upgrade, and we need, we're looking at inventory control components, both for routine vaccination and then for SNS response, CRA type of work. So,
thanks. I think this will be our last question, I hope.
Dan Hockenfer from Wisconsin, just a couple of comments. And I don't know if this is DAX related or not, but I'm hearing a lot of discussion on the need for tetanus vaccine in a flooding situation. And I think CDC needs to help us address that because there's a lot of confusion as to whether it's recommended or not. So that would be helpful. The second comment is in regards to the first set of slides when it was said that 50 states and territories were invited to participate. That infers that it was voluntary. It did sound voluntary to me.
Okay. Okay. Now tell us how you really feel, Dan.
I didn't pick up on the invited. The question, though, is, and also the original presentation, they talked about for next year increased volume of the information that you need, and I wonder if you could comment on that a little bit so we can start preparing for that.
Yeah, one of the additional requirements would be to include a mass vaccination clinic, and in many cases people have already included those in their plans, but there are cases where that's not included. So that's one of the ways. And then also we're encouraging in states where they're collecting all of the information to just send us all the data. You know, the subset of data, you don't need to adjust to have only 8 clinics and so forth.
Thank you, Jeannie. Well, this has been very, very stimulating. We've had some great questions and some great answers. I hope you take this information with you and back to your states and can think forward for the next exercise, which takes place this October. I have a few housekeeping notes here for you. The next session will begin at 11. So please refer to your pages 26 and 27 of your agenda to identify and locate your session. The second immunization Q&A session will take place in Lone Star Ballroom A1, A2 during the lunch break today beginning at 12:30. Lunch is not provided. Please feel free to bring lunch. Please see page 9 in your agenda book for more information about the Q&A session. The next hour of the conference is dedicated to poster and exhibit viewing. You will find light refreshment in the exhibit area. And the last thing is there will be another DAX conference this year, and it will be in Atlanta, and it'll be August 26th through the 28th, connected to the FinMS conference, and it'll be at the Holiday Inn in Decatur, and you'll be getting flyers and emails. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Yeah, you too. Thank you.